This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. On Monday night, the New Orleans Saints will host the Atlanta Falcons in an early season matchup of undefeated NFC South rivals. The Saints are coming off what amounts to an 18-game road trip in the wake of Hurricane Katrina, including their so-called home games in Baton Rouge and San Antonio last season. As Ron Schachter reports from the Crescent City, Monday's contest could well be the Saints' most important game of the year.
All around New Orleans, construction crews are laboring to put this hurricane-ravaged city back together again. Conventions are coming back to the large hotels. The casinos are up and running, and tourists are boarding the Mississippi Paddle Wheelers dock near the French Quarter. And when the Saints kick off here Monday night for the first regular season game in almost 2 years, they'll be writing the latest chapter in New Orleans' difficult comeback. Mike Triplett covers the Saints for the New Orleans Times-Picayune and says that the return of the home team and its owner Tom Benson was no sure thing.
There was a growing fear maybe that the team may never come back at all. The owner had some ties to San Antonio, and there were reports and then rumors that he may permanently want to keep the team in San Antonio. But ever since about January, the NFL kind of stepped in and, you know, really worked hard, and then the owner kind of embraced the city again.
The Saints' arrival also hinged on the speedy recovery of the Louisiana Superdome, whose crumpled roof and scenes of suffering became one of the most visible national emblems of the Katrina catastrophe. Superdome manager Doug Thornton, who's in charge of the $185 million reconstruction project, races by golf cart around the stadium. He points out the 20,000 replaced seats rising above the vivid green and white of new artificial turf. And he ticks off some other sizable details of dome improvement.
800,000 square feet of ceiling tile had to be removed and replaced. 750,000 square feet of drywall. So when you stop and you think about the sheer magnitude of it, it's overwhelming.
Thornton adds that 1 year after the ravages of Katrina, the Superdome has become a different kind of emblem.
You know, the fact that people saw it for so many days with a roof that was torn off and ripped to shreds, to be able to restore this building in such a rapid manner, you know, in less than a year, and have it look the way that it looks now, I think is going to be an inspiration to the people of New Orleans when they walk in here. They're going to believe and have confidence that if this building can be rehabilitated, then maybe there's hope for their city.
Saints wide receiver Joe Horn, who spent the past six seasons in New Orleans, says he's seen that new spirit firsthand.
The fans can't wait. I talk to them all the time. They're glad that we're here. They're glad that we're back in New Orleans, and they're blessed to have us back, and we're blessed to be back.
Seventh-year linebacker Steve Gleason, a Saints lifer, has spent the past year helping his wife's family rebuild two destroyed houses and a lost business. He sees more to Monday night's game than the final score.
Our focus is to win the game versus the Falcons, and that's our number one goal. But I think we all understand that just being back here is going to be so great and electric for the city. You know, you can feel the energy already just based on our performance so far and all the season tickets that have been sold.
The Saints have sold out the season for the first time in their 40-year history. It's helped that they've won their first two games with newly acquired quarterback Drew Brees and Heisman-winning running back Reggie Bush. Last week, Brees passed for 353 yards and two touchdowns against the Packers. In week one against the Browns, Bush made his NFL debut with 141 all-purpose yards. And while no one's lining up for playoff tickets yet, the Times-Picayune's Triplett says last season's 3-13 record is becoming a distant memory.
It's one of the most remarkable turnarounds I've seen in sports because it was just one series of moves after another. People were excited to hear the Superdome was going to be rebuilt, and then they hired a coach that people kind of liked, Sean Payton, and then Reggie Bush fell into their laps on draft day, and that was just the absolute icing on the cake.
They'll light the candles Monday night before a national TV audience. With New Orleans' population cut in half and whole sections of the city still in disrepair, the Saints' return promises a psychological and financial boost. One University of New Orleans economist has estimated that past football seasons have generated as much as $100 million for the local economy. There's still a question of whether a small market like New Orleans can keep the Saints over the long run. Their Superdome lease is up in a few years, and Fred Price, the chairman of the New Orleans Chamber of Commerce, says that the business community needs to keep anteing up for season tickets and the Superdome's expensive corporate suites.
We have people from all walks of life that have invested in those suites. We have lawyers who have bought the suites to entertain clients. We have physicians who have done that. We have others who managed to get together a group and do that so they could support the Saints coming back to New Orleans. We're trying to figure out a way to support the Saints in whatever way we can.
For Only a Game, I'm Ron Schachter in New Orleans.
Joining me now on the line is Benjamin Hockman of the New Orleans Times-Picayune. Ben, as we just heard, the return of the Saints to the Superdome has been seen as a sign that the city is on its way back. But with all the problems that still plague New Orleans, is that really true?
Well, it's interesting. The Superdome is a symbol of the hope of this city. And yes, there's a lot of things that are coming back, and be it the Saints, be it businesses and such, but there's a little hopelessness lingering around here, too. It's almost a juxtaposition here in town. And for every Saints fan excited going to the game, there's another person who can't get his or her own home going. And there's a lingering frustration. A lot of progress needs to be done in our city.
Has anyone felt uncomfortable with the prospect of business as usual at the Superdome just a year after it was the site of some horrific events?
No, I think everyone is in agreement that this is perfect for our city. This is what we need, a symbol comparing to what happened last year. I mean, the fact that there were thousands of people in this dome scared and starving, and now, like, I keep saying the word symbol, but I think it's the perfect word to describe the hope in our town. Now everyone is uniting for the Saints, and yes, the Saints are a floundering franchise, but they're 2-0, and everyone is excited about it. And I think it's important for our city.
Tulane University football returns to the Superdome next week, and this will be the first home game for that team after essentially 14 straight road games. Forget optimism. Is it just going to be weird to see the green wave back home?
Well, I was talking to one of the players' mothers the other day, and she's just excited about seeing the players wearing green. They've been wearing their white road uniforms since September of 2005.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Tulane's just excited to get back. I mean, they're almost used to not being home.
Well, you covered Tulane football for the Times-Picayune last year. Tell me a little bit about what the team went through during its season without a home game.
It was unfathomable. You have these players who, they didn't know what was going on with their homes. Soon they found out many of them were homeless. They were fatigued, and they were tired, and they moved from New Orleans to Ruston, Louisiana, tried to focus on school and football. What they did was amazing. 11 games in 11 different cities, not one bye week to rest. They didn't have a locker room. They had a makeshift meeting rooms. They were 2-9 last year, but they were successful just for showing up on Saturdays.
Katrina scattered the athletic program at Tulane along with most of the rest of the student body to the four corners of the continent. How was the university gone about rebuilding?
It's been a struggle for Tulane. There is some optimism, though. They had to cut about half of their athletic programs, but the teams that are back, they seem resilient and they seem rejuvenated, but there's money issues. They tried to save about $2 million by getting rid of these programs, and now they're clawing back, taking donations and putting it together as well as they can. The football team had to schedule three games against SEC teams, traveling to Auburn, traveling to LSU, just to get a check, to make some money, and it's been a struggle for them. But they have a good leader in Rick Dixon. I know him pretty well, and he's a resilient guy. Tulane Athletics is, if you will, a business in New Orleans, and just like any other business in New Orleans, it will be fascinating to see if they can recover.
I've read stories about Tulane students who went elsewhere to pursue their university education because of Katrina and who found a home somewhere else, in Massachusetts, in Ohio, in California, and said, I don't think I want to go back to New Orleans. Has that happened with any of the athletes?
Well, a few of the football players, for instance, have transferred. A lot of the situation is because of majors. Tulane University had to get rid of some of their majors. So, for instance, one of the kickers on the team had to transfer to a school in Texas. And some of the other players, you know, were pretty frustrated with the situation. But a core group of Tulane students and Tulane student athletes are back. And as one player once said, the phonies are gone.
And there is a sense, I gather, at Tulane of, you know, maybe we have something more to do than just get degrees.
Exactly. Tulane is promoting community service among all of its students, and you see these kids, they're helping the city, gutting houses, raising money, collecting clothing, and things like that. To be a Tulane student, I've noticed just by talking to students and to teachers and professors and such, it seems like it means more to be a Tulane person these days.
It's no surprise, certainly no secret, that New Orleans and the Southeast take football very seriously. Has Katrina forced perspective on both the Saints and Tulane fans, or has the potential chance for a diversion here made football more important than ever?
I would say football is more important than ever, and if you had asked someone in 2002 if football could ever be more important than it is in Louisiana, they would laugh. Football in this state, it's almost religious. And now it's important, not just because it's what you bond with your friends about, but it is a reason for hope. It's a sign of normalcy. Okay, I'm spending the day rebuilding my house and trying to get this insurance together and get my kids in school and all these things, but at the end of the day, I can just sit back and get ready to watch the Tulane Green Wave football team or the LSU Tigers or, obviously, the New Orleans Saints. And the fact that the Saints are 2-0 and two road wins. Obviously, their opponents weren't necessarily the best teams in the NFL, but they got two wins on the road, and this city is buzzing, and it is important for these people.
Benjamin Hockman joined me from New Orleans. He covers sports for the New Orleans Times-Picayune. Ben, thanks again.
Hey, thanks for having me.
You can share your comments with Only a Game by writing us, care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215, or by emailing oag@wbur.bu.edu. Please let us know on which station you hear Only a Game and how to pronounce your name. You can leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can visit Only a Game's website at www.onlyagame.org. I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up in a matter of instance on Only a Game, Instant Replay Replayed. But first, in National League action last night, Los Angeles beat Arizona 2-0, but San Diego negated any progress the Dodgers might have made by overcoming Pittsburgh 6-2. The Padres retain a half-game lead in the National League West. The Phils beat the Marlins 5-2, meaning that they are still just half a game behind L.A. in the contest for the National League's wild card. In the American League, the Tigers humbled the Royals 7-3, while the Twins dropped one to the Orioles by the same score. Minnesota is now a game and a half behind Detroit in the AL Central, but the Twins have a 6.5 game lead over the White Sox for the American League's wild card. Hunched on the bench in the visitors' dugout at Fenway Park on Wednesday evening, surrounded by slender, excitable lads recently arrived from AAA ball, Rick Stelmasek stared balefully out at the infield. Most of the young men who'd recently joined the Minnesota Twins from their minor league affiliate in Rochester, New York, didn't know that Stelmasek held a Twins record. For 26 years, he's been the team's bullpen coach. No Twins coach has matched his longevity. I suggested this must mean he's been pretty good at his job.
No, I got a pickpocket career. It kind of tricks them. Once they figure out what I'm doing, I'm in trouble.
With over a quarter of a century in service, that seems unlikely, even if all Stelmasek does is answer the phone when Twins manager Ron Gardenhire wants a pitcher or two to get loose. In any case, Stelmasek's position in the bullpen has given him an excellent perspective from which to appreciate the extraordinary performance of closer Joe Nathan and the rest of Minnesota's relief pitchers this season. In the 77 games during which the Twins have been leading in the eighth inning, they have lost exactly none. Can even the most veteran of veteran bullpen coaches explain it?
The way we look at our bullpen, it's a rotation within a rotation. You have guys that they're set up for the sixth and seventh, guys for the eighth, and you try to piece it together to get to Nathan. And they all know their roles. They work at it. They pay attention, and they go in there and do their job, and we've been very fortunate.
Yeah, but, Coach, a lot of teams could say, they know their roles, and we got this guy for the sixth and this guy for the eighth. But did you expect that this particular group could have this kind of success?
No, I mean, that's a big number you're talking about, and we're just enjoying every moment of it as the season goes along.
Of course, even a team with a closer whose earned run average is under 2 won't contend if they can't score runs themselves. Among those responsible for that lately has been effervescent outfielder Torrey Hunter, who hit home runs Tuesday and Wednesday nights to help the Twins pull to within half a game of the division-leading Detroit Tigers. Hunter credits Terry Ryan, Minnesota's general manager, with much of the team's success.
He tried to keep the chemistry and the camaraderie together, and I think that's what he's always focusing on. I mean, it's not good to have camaraderie with you know, the players that suck.
Right.
But we actually have camaraderie, and we do have some good players over here, and I think that makes everything right.
Certainly it has helped make everything right since June, when the Twins shook off the mediocrity that had characterized their spring play. And even more certainly, camaraderie and good players have succeeded when it has mattered most, which is recently. Through Wednesday night, while the White Sox were slumping and the Tigers were holding on to first place by their claws, Minnesota had won 4 games in a row and 8 of their last 10. According to Pat Neshek, a rookie reliever with 4 wins this season, who was a Twins fan as a child, the achievement has not gone unnoticed at home.
You know, it's pretty crazy out there right now. You know, we're having attendance records there, you know, the best since 92, 91 when they last went to the World Series. So it's nice. A lot of my family and, you know, friends are back to being Twins fans again and stuff like that, you know, and it's been a long drought. So it's nice.
It's especially nice and a little weird for people who recall that only 5 years ago, Major League Baseball Commissioner Bud Selig was making noises about eliminating the Twins entirely. Too bad for the Tigers and the White Sox that it didn't happen, and equally too bad for them that the Twins have survived and flourished despite the loss of ace pitcher Francisco Liriano to an injury a month ago, a loss that outfielder Torrey Hunter regards as a challenge.
Yeah, I feel good, man. You know, going into, you know, this last week of the season, I think we got a good chance of getting in there. Once we get in there with Liriano out, that's the question, you know. But at the same time, we have some young guys that come up from AAA, and they've been pitching pretty well. But once you get into the playoffs, it's a different pressure.
Right.
It's a different adrenaline. So we're going to see if these guys can handle that. I'm sure they never pitched in something this big before.
On the brink of the playoffs, those AAA players to whom Torrey Hunter is referring will be turning to the veterans for advice on all sorts of things. How to handle the increasing number of reporters and broadcasters who'll be crowding into the clubhouse from now until this season's Minnesota story ends, for example, and how to carry on in the routines that have worked so far despite various other distractions, such as ticket requests, a problem with which bullpen coach Rick Stelmasek is familiar.
Definitely, yeah. You have a lot of friends that you haven't seen in 40 years or 30 years, and you've already forgotten their face and names, and oh, you remember me, they're your close personal friends now, and you just have to know when to cut it off.
It's a problem, sure, but it's a problem that coaches and players on 24 other Major League Baseball teams would love to have. In 1967, Jerry Kramer, then an offensive lineman with the Green Bay Packers, and journalist Dick Schaap collaborated to produce Instant Replay, the story of the Packers' 67 season. Kramer kept a journal of the season, which saw the Packers win their second Super Bowl. Schaap edited and shaped Kramer's account. Reissued this fall, Instant Replay, the Green Bay Diary of Jerry Kramer, is at once quaint and timely. I'm joined now by former Packer Jerry Kramer. He's at KBSU in Boise, Idaho. Mr. Kramer, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you, Bill. Great to be with you.
What was your reaction when you learned that Instant Replay would be replayed yet again?
Well, you know, that's been a continuing source of amazement, I guess. When we sat down to do the book initially in 1966, 67, it's of the 67 season, I asked Dick, I said, what's the average book sell? And he says, 5,000 copies. And I said, what do we have to do good? What's good? He said, oh, about 30,000 copies. So we were hoping to sell 30,000 copies back then. And, of course, we sold about 400,000 in hard and 3 million in paper. And,
whoa.
And it was on the bestseller list for 40 weeks. So we were stunned. I mean, absolutely. And so was the publisher, by the way, because they were always out of books, it seemed, at that time.
One of the things that seems to me quaint about the book now is the amounts of money you and your teammates earned playing football. The extra $25,000 each Packer got for winning the NFL championship and the Super Bowl, that was big-time motivation, right?
I'm not sure I'd call it quaint, Bill, but it was different, certainly. Yes, it was big-time motivation. It was serious money. It doubled our income for the year. So it was big money to us, and we played in a time when television just started. The league was just coming of age, kind of. Professional football was coming of age. So we would get $50 for a speaking engagement. And I remember being asked to do a local commercial in Wisconsin for a milk company. And they wanted 7 all-pros, the guys who had been all-pro the year before. And the PR guy came up to me and said, asked me if I'd like to do it. And I said, what kind of money they got? He said, $350. I said, $350? I'm not doing it for $350. He goes, no, Jerry, the $350 is for all 7 of you.
This brings the question up, what were some of the other things that motivated you and your teammates?
Well, pride, Coach Lombardi, just that basic nature, I guess, of wanting some recognition and wanting to do well. Coach was a sensational motivator. He had a very solid set of fundamentals. He believed in preparing us properly. He wanted a commitment from us, mind, body, heart, and soul, but most of all that person you look at in the mirror in the morning and the evening. He wanted discipline. He wanted perseverance. He wanted so many of the basics. And he worked us so hard, Bill. I mean, in the first couple training camps, we had guys losing consciousness on the field, passing out in the chow line at lunchtime. They'd be standing there and whoop, they'd just keel over. God. There was something about December when the guys would say, remember July, somebody's going to pay. Somebody's going to pay for this. So it was a combination of pride and expectations and will, and of course the coach wanted it.
Well, Coach Lombardi is, of course, an enormous presence in this book. And at one point you wrote, it's ridiculous the way supposedly adult individuals cower and hide from one short, fat Italian. Why did the Packers cower and hide?
The short, fat Italian had an intensity about him, a will, a fire, a burn, a hunger. He once said he had a burning incandescence in his gut. That kind of explains him pretty well. He just had an incredible drive, and he wouldn't hesitate to snap at you, to jump at you, to chew your tail at any time in any place. That one phrase, that short, fat Italian, made me concerned about giving him a book. I'm telling you, I'd given all the other coaches books, and I'd given all the players books, and I gave it to him like on Tuesday, and then it's like Friday or Saturday, we're getting ready to go to Milwaukee for a ball game on the bus. And Marie Lombardi comes up to me and gets right in my face and says, where's my book? Well, I got it out in the car. I was kind of struggling over the inscription, didn't know what to say to the coach. Well, I want my book, and I want it now. Well, I went and got it, and I had struggled, like I said, with the inscription. I finally decided I would inscribe Coach Lombardi's book rather than best wishes or good luck or something inane like that. I put, for Coach Vincent T. Lombardi, a man against whom all others shall forever be measured. And I hope that would offset the short, fat Italian line. But I gave the book to Marie, and she read it on the bus to Milwaukee and then that next night. And I came out of the, I jumped on the elevator the next morning and stopped at the floor, and she jumped on. She said, Jerry, I love the book. I love it. It helps me to understand. I said, what, football? No, him.
Well, at one point, you're describing an injury to one of Green Bay's safeties, Tommy Brown, and the team doctor tells Brown that he's fine and go back in the game, and you write, quote, that is what the doctor would tell you if you broke your neck during a close game. Did anybody connected with the Packers take issue with remarks like that one? I mean, beyond the short, fat Italian.
It was pretty much true, Bill. During that time, we had a kid, Lionel Aldrich, broke a bone in his leg, and he's out running on his leg about 10, 12 days after it. And Coach Lombardi says, Aldrich, the bone you broke is not a weight-bearing bone. You don't even need that bone in your leg. Now run on it. So Kenny Bowman, our center, dislocated the shoulder. His arm and the top of his shoulder would come around to his chest. It would just totally dislocate, and it was a gruesome, horrible-looking thing. And the trainer would get Kenny to lay down on the ground. The trainer would put one leg on his neck, one leg under his arm, and jerk that arm back into place. And Kenny would, just scream. It was an ugly thing to watch. And next week, Bo would be out there. He'd have a chain across his, or a big strap about 4 inches, 5 inches wide across his chest, a big strap on his arm, and a chain between the arm and the chest so that the shoulder wouldn't go out anymore. Mm. So we played with those little hurts.
You note in the book that at least some of your teammates were aware that you were taking notes and that those notes might very well end up being a book. Jim Bouton got blackballed from baseball for doing that with ball four. Did the publication of Instant Replay cause you any difficulties?
Not at all, Bill. I didn't go into people's private lives, and I didn't go into areas that I thought were inappropriate. I tried to stick to the game and the personalities and the people. And I thought about writing the book initially, and I wanted to get very flowery and large words and very literary. And I go, hey, it is what it is, and you are what you are. Just tell it the way you see it, the way you believe it to be, and be as dead honest as you can be. And that's all you need to do. And the next year, I give you an idea of how the guys felt about it. Force Gregg and Gail Gillingham lived across the hallway from me, and I had a record that I played in the evening about the time we went to sleep, and it was called One Stormy Night, and there were thunder and lightning and rain sounds, and it was kind of peaceful. And I had that record on, and Gail Gillingham went down to the John and got a cup of water and came in and threw it on me, and they were giggling. It was lights out, of course, and we were like a couple children, but they're giggling, and said something about the rain. And then somebody said, my roommate, Willie Davis, said, you better watch out. He'll put that in the next book. And Forrest Gregg says, that damn book. That's all I've heard about is that damn book. I'm getting pretty sick of that book. I'll tell you one thing, don't Jerry. You were dead honest. And that, to me, was high praise.
Jerry, you wrote in Instant Replay that sometimes at banquets during the off-season, they would show film of games, and you would watch, and you would think, can I really be playing such a violent game? I assume you're still watching pro football today. Do you still sometimes feel the same way?
Yeah, you do, Bill. If you get in the middle of things there, and you're so intense, and you're so focused on your job and what you have to do, you sometimes forget about the violence of it. You just go all out and do everything you can. But I was down on the Packers sidelines a couple weeks ago, and the closer you get to the action, the more violent it seems. The thuds, the grunts, the hits, the whacks, the whole thing. Of course, the kids are bigger today and they're faster today, and so you have more mass moving at greater speed, so you have more violent collisions. And you can't help but wince sometimes when these guys are wailing down there and they smack somebody right in front of you. Wow. And you wonder, you really do wonder about going back and being in the middle of all that violence and coming out of it with a few minor injuries, you know.
Jerry Kramer was an offensive lineman with the Green Bay Packers from 1958 until 1968. He and journalist Dick Schaap wrote Instant Replay, which has been reissued by Doubleday. Mr. Kramer joined me from KBSU in Boise, Idaho. Thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you very much.
If you're a member of the Weekend Late Risers Club or find yourself otherwise indisposed when Only a Game hits the conventional airwaves, please go to onlyagame.org and click on podcast. 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where Only a Game is produced. Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information available at Bicon.com, BICON.com. And the Dairy Farm families who own Cabot Creamery, five generations of farming and making naturally aged cheddar cheese in Vermont, on the web at CabotCheese.com. This is NPR.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, the happy hydraulic hop of the low riders. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
Europe was up 5-3 after yesterday's Ryder Cup competition in Ireland. In Friday foursomes, Tiger Woods and Jim Furyk fell to Luke Donald and Sergio Garcia. In the preceding four-ball competition, Furyk saved his partner, who has had to deal with a few distractions, hasn't he?
Yes, it's gotten a little silly in Ireland, those crafty Hibernian fellows. My crafty ancestors are making our lad, the former Eldrick Woods, very upset. First of all, there were the photos that a magazine... First of all, I can't say this because it's too funny. First of all, there was the magazine that linked photos of his wife to various pornography sites, for which Tiger, I think, pronounced himself properly outraged. Then they made him sing. Tiger was supposed to do it, and he tried to sneak off, and bad for him. Perhaps he was, you know, going to the internet to kill out some posts. Who knows?
As you know, wind can be a real problem for golfers, but in the case of this year's Ryder Cup, it's been a problem for spectators as well.
The funny thing is that I have actually played this course as recently as a month ago.
You're not going to tell me what every shot...
They're real. Well, no, we have nowhere near enough time to go shot by shot. We would be here till Thursday. But the interesting thing, of course, there were three people injured. There's been very, very high winds in Ireland. But, of course, the interesting thing is that the K Club is deliberately set up not to be an Irish golf course. It's a little bit of North Carolina dropped in the middle of a small town in Kildare. You want to play Irish golf in the wind, go to Portmarnock, go to Ballybunion, go someplace near the ocean, then you'll get some wind. But the fact that someplace is insulated from all of that is the K Club is having problems with wind gives you an idea of what it would be like if they played it at an actual Irish golf course.
On Thursday, a federal judge ordered that San Francisco Chronicle reporters Mark Fainaruwata and Lance Williams be jailed until they reveal who leaked Barry Bonds' secret grand jury testimony to them. They will appeal the ruling, during which time they will not be in prison. How is this going to be resolved?
It's going to be resolved when either, I have a feeling, near as I can tell, when either they testify or whoever it was leaked them the grand jury testimony steps forward. This seems to be one of those irreconcilable problems that's going to end up in jail.
Remarkably, the New York Yankees will finish first in the American League's Eastern Division. Charlie, having assured that outcome, I understand the Yankees have now turned
cut
to group
off
therapy.
Cut my legs and call me Shorty. you don't even have to cut off my legs to do that. There was an interesting story by Tom Verducci in Sports Illustrated where apparently Joe Torre, at the instigation of Jason Giambi, clubhouse leader, got tough with Alex Rodriguez and told him to get over himself and be the player that they're paying for. It's an interesting story. It's a very interesting examination of the dynamic within a baseball clubhouse. My only question is, who the hell is Jason Giambi to tell anybody anything at this point in his life?
Oh, come on. Forgiveness and mercy, Charlie.
Let me get this straight, because I want the what shall we tell the children crowd on this issue to come explain this to me. If Barry Bonds had made nice and apologized, he would be now recognized as a clubhouse leader and a good guy. I mean, suddenly Jason Giambi is your team spokesman. The guy's not long removed from every sentence he said, beginning with the phrase, to the best of my recollection.
Meanwhile, moving along to National League action, would you care to comment on perhaps the most unlikely ninth inning played this season, or maybe in any season?
Four home runs in one inning for the...
In a row.
Back to back to back to back. Is that four? Back to back to back to back. Yes, four. And then Nomar, our old friend Nomar Garcia-Parra, winning the game in the 10th.
With another home run.
A really bad loss for the San Diego Padres. I should point out that at least one of the home runs in this epical ninth inning was hit off Rudy Cianez of the San Diego Padres, late of the Boston Red Sox. So it's entirely possible that Rudy Cianez may be responsible for two teams falling out of the pennant race in one year in both leagues.
Are you surprised at the way the wild card races finally seem to be shaking themselves out?
I'm a little bit surprised that they've shaken out so definitively in the American League, with Minnesota really coming on strong at the end. I think the Phillies have hung on a lot longer than I thought they would. I mean, if there's an easier vote than Ryan Howard for National League Most Valuable Player this year, I don't know what it is. you know, and the Dodgers, that game against the Padres is one of those games you win when you're going to wind up in the playoffs. So I think the Dodgers may stagger through, but the National League is closer and the American League is further apart than I thought they were going to be.
The fans of one team that won't make it to the postseason, the Baltimore Orioles, showed their displeasure in rather a curious way on Thursday night, don't you think?
Yes, they're walking out. They want the Orioles freed from the grips, from the talons, as it were, of Peter Angelos, because they say he doesn't run the team. I mean, we've talked about this before. There's only one unsolvable problem for a sports fan, and that's a bad owner. Once you have a bad owner, barring his being a crook in other areas or a crazy person like Marge Schott, there's no way to get rid of a bad owner.
The instant replay official who failed to overturn a bad call in the Oregon-Oklahoma game last weekend has been granted a leave of absence, which will apparently begin right after he and the rest of the officials from that game serve their suspensions. Does the punishment fit the crime here?
I'm not entirely sure. While it's good to see a governing body admit that its officials can make mistakes and should pay a price for having done so, they made a mistake. It's the most graphic, I think, example of the changes wrought in the game by instant replay technology that I can think of.
In my favorite pro football story of the week, Charlie, the Atlanta Falcons have signed a 46-year-old kicker. Tell me it's Satchel Paige.
No, it's actually not. It's Morten Andersen. First of all, I'd like to say that I really appreciate the fact that the Atlanta Falcons train in Flowery Branch, Georgia. Isn't that nice? Doesn't it sound like the little dum-dum tree should be growing in Flowery Branch, Georgia, where men go down to the tinky-winky shop and beat the crap out of each other?
It says football to me.
Yeah, they signed Morten Andersen. He's an 8-time Pro Bowler. He's played practically everywhere. He's a great indoor kicker, which makes him not only the perfect kicker for the Falcons who play in the Georgia Dome, but this week they're playing in New Orleans, where Morten Andersen was enormously successful. It's a good story, and I'm telling you what, it's a pretty good signing for Atlanta. It shows a little bit of imagination.
Lots of people have been looking for tickets for that first game in the Superdome in more than a year. How do you like the offer Saints running back Reggie Bush got for some of his tickets?
Yeah, Reggie Bush said his massage therapist told him, quote, she'd trade some massages for tickets. We'll work that out. Fine, Reggie, and we'll leave the story right about there, although it is nice to see that certain things about New Orleans culture are coming back to life.
On Thursday, the U.S. women fell to Russia in the World Basketball Championship semis. You'd expect such behavior from U.S. men, but the women.
26 games in a row they had won in this event, and they lost it. They lost fairly substantially to the Russians, 75-68. Big win for the Russians and a very surprising loss for the ladies of the United States.
And finally, Charlie, 73 surfers seeking to set a record in South Africa.
They had to ride the same wave for 5 seconds, and they say they broke a Guinness Book of World Records for 44 people in Ireland. The interesting thing about this, it was a fundraiser for Shark Spotters, a safety program under which people will, like, cruise the beaches and warn swimmers of lurking sharks. So in other words, this world record could either be most surfers on the same wave or largest single piece of fish food.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine. His latest book, Moving the Chains, Tom Brady and the Pursuit of Everything, will be in stores on Halloween. He joins me each week at this time. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
Bill King of New Market, Virginia, was unhappy with my conversation on last week's program with Paul Quadros regarding his experiences coaching a high school soccer team in North Carolina made up largely of Latino students. On the one hand, Mr. King wrote, the coach labored to teach his players the rules of the game and discipline. On the other hand, when it comes to the rules of immigration, it's a matter of rules. We don't need no stinking rules. The whole problem with illegal aliens is that they are aliens who are illegal. This story never should have aired. My association with Only a Game has been terminated. Tony Kramer, who hears Only a Game on WAMC in Albany, New York, sent us an email recently that began, perhaps I missed it, but no good usually comes from emails that begin that way, and Mr. Kramer was upset that I hadn't spent more time acknowledging the retirements of Martina Navratilova, Andre Agassi, and Formula One driver Michael Schumacher. Regarding the latter two, I discussed their achievements with Charlie Pierce last week. A few weeks ago, I did speak at some length with Martina Navratilova, who made no secret of her intention to retire again. And when she retires again, I'm sure she'll once again make no secret of it. Michelle O'Brien, a WBUR listener, appreciated Trish Anderton's story on last week's program about the surfers helping children stay healthy in Indonesia. It was fascinating to hear an example of effective grassroots organizing overseas, she wrote, led by, of all people, surfers. John Andrew Caputa, who hears the show by visiting onlyagame.org, heard my commentary about the mercy rule as it applies in some amateur baseball leagues. He was happily reminded of the day upon which his high school baseball team was mercying the other side 20-0 after 6 innings, at which point everybody cried, "Enough," and sensibly tapped the dirt from their cleats and went home. You can let us know what you think of the program by emailing us at onlyagame@wbur.bu.edu. You can also reach us through our website, onlyagame.org. Our address is onlyagame, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. You can leave a message on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. If you enjoy competitions featuring automobiles but prefer that the cars stay in one spot rather than careen around an oval 300, 400, or 500 times, you'll want to listen to the following story by Only a Game's Charlie Schroeder.
About 10,000 people have gathered at the National Orange Show, a fairground and racetrack in San Bernardino, 60 miles east of Los Angeles. They're here for the Lowrider Magazine Car Show, a pageant of custom cars, merchandise, nearly naked girls, and of course the 50 souped-up junkers with enough hydraulic power to launch their front ends into the stratosphere during today's car hop competition.
Welcome to the Lowrider Car Show, 2006 San Bernardino style. We're going to do the hop competition in about another 30 minutes, right here at the main pavilion.
Despite having just turned 31, Gilbert Gonzalez is currently enjoying his 14th year as a professional hopper. The San Antonio, Texas resident towed his black 1986 Ford Ranger 1,300 miles for the big event.
How high can this truck go?
That should be over your head, probably about 80 inches in that area, 85.
That's 85 inches from the bottom of its front tires to the ground, or the same height as Shaquille O'Neal. How does Gilbert make his car hop so high?
You gotta be in his zone. The way I do myself is I just try to get myself mad at the car.
Of course, the 8 car batteries and 3 hydraulic pumps taking up half of the truck's bed probably help too. You've seen versions of lowriders, usually Chevy Impalas from the Kennedy administration years, bouncing their way through hip-hop videos and fast food commercials. They've been refurbished and detailed into rolling, hopping hydraulic works of art, replete with iconic Chicano imagery, always, it seems, accompanied by the thumping beat of hip-hop.
10 more minutes right here, main pavilion, hop competition.
I excuse myself from Gilbert so he can muster the appropriate amount of anger and head to the bleachers. There I engage my neighbors, Big Daddy, Rocky, Tiny, and Dave, 4 very large men with shaved heads, goatees, and black t-shirts, all seemingly unaffected by the 90-degree California sun. So when did all this start, I asked Dave.
Well, I've been doing it since 72.
The foursome, 3/4 Latino, 1/4 African-American, stoically nod in agreement. Lowriding, they tell me, had its genesis back in the late 60s, early 70s, when Chicanos, politically active Mexican-Americans, first experimented with old abandoned Impalas. The cars were cheap, but looked good. Plus, they were easy to work on. Since then, lowriding has risen in popularity, first penetrating the West Coast hip-hop community, and then, as a result of its presence in music videos, spreading into Germany and Japan. Now it's practically mainstream, says Mill Kinsey, another contestant in today's hop.
You would think, you know, this would be just minorities out here, but there's all different colors out here. It's all fun and game.
Fun and games, like
somebody flipping the car.
That's what Tiny tells me he wants to see. Yes, these cars sometimes hop so high, they actually flip over backwards. Now, no one's in the car while this is happening. The switchman, as he's called, stands outside the car and controls it with a switch box that resembles a large home video game control. It's tethered to the inside of the vehicle, near the dashboard, and as Rocky tells me, acts as a remote control for the hydraulics.
It's all about timing. You're trying to get a good bounce out of the front, and as soon as you catch that bounce the right way, you hit the switch at the right time, the car starts to climb up higher and higher every single time.
Gilbert Gonzalez with his 86 Ranger coming all the way from San Antonio, Texas.
Oh, my. He's in it to win it.
Gilbert, score to be 64 inches.
Not that far.
No music, please.
Gilbert, the veteran hopper from San Antonio, chooses to hop in silence, a decision that no doubt helps him channel his anger. He stands about 10 feet from his truck, switchbox in hand, takes a deep breath, and flips the switch. With a sudden jolt of electricity, the black pickup starts to shiver, then hop really high.
They're going to be mad at you! They're going to be mad at you!
Oh, there goes the light.
Blinker.
Oh, no, and it caught on fire!
Later, I visit with a dejected Gonzalez and talk with him about his performance.
Man, my motor burned. I took it to the car wash at the Blue Beacon, and the truck's in an angle. And what happened when they rinsed the trucks, the water went into the motor. So I toasted the motor.
It's a surprisingly amateurish mistake for the 14-year vet. Yet despite frying his motor, Gonzalez finishes second today with a hop of 76 inches. And while his carelessness at the car wash might make tomorrow's trip back to Texas that much longer, he remains optimistic.
Oh, yeah, and I learned, you know, it's a learning experience, so no problem.
As Gonzalez shuffles away, dreaming about what might have been, an ice-blue 87 Buick Regal sporting an airbrushed mural of Jesus on its trunk has performed a miracle. It's
standing straight up! There we go! Make some noise!
Improbably, it's just inches from flipping over backwards into total destruction, much to the delight of the crowd.
How are we going to push this thing down now?
For Only a Game, I'm Charlie Schroeder in San Bernardino, California.
That's what happens when you get your car like that. You don't think about how to get it down.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from Tom Taylor at KBSU in Boise, Idaho, and our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll-free. CDs and cassettes are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to learn more about Instant Replay, listen to stories past and present, or sign up for our newsletter, please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from reporter Charlie Schroeder.
Anytime that I get off work from my regular job is time well spent.
Let's look at Charlie's resume for a minute here. I guess doing stories on lowriders is more interesting than acting in an episode of Sex and the City. Who knew? I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from WBUR Boston. The Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in children, their families, and their communities. On the web at WKKF.org. Anne and John Herman, supporting City Year and the young adults who dedicate a year of their lives to community service and leadership development. CityYear.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, with a new website at MacFound.org. This is NPR, National.